Good morning, everyone. My name is Sarah Hinnick, and I am an alcoholic. And it is by God's grace and His mercy and the miracle of this fellowship and sponsorship, both having one and being one, that I have not found it necessary to take a drink since July 5th of 1995. It's a good thing you guys can't see my knees because they're kind of shaking here. I want to start out, I want you to indulge me for a moment. I would like to take another moment of silence to invite God into the room, please. Thank you. And I'd like to start out by thanking Zan and Harlan for inviting me. I was at the Women's International when it was in Portland, and I've been to, I think, eight. This last one was my eighth. I usually volunteer for whatever they need me to do. I served on the board there, too. But when I volunteer, I would get on panels and stuff like that. And so I spoke on a panel, and this lady came running up to me after the panel and handed me a scrap of paper with her phone number on it and said, please call me, please call me. And I thought I must have said something that rang a bell with her or something and kind of put it in my pocket and went on my way. When I got home from the conference, I called her and I said, hi, you know, you gave me your phone number. And she says, yeah, we'd like to invite you to come speak. Well, my ego hits the ceiling and my knees hit the floor. So, then I'm thinking, you got the right person? Are you sure you want me to come speak? I'm not sure about that. And so here I am. And Harlan and I have been emailing back and forth for the last year and a little more than a year. It was me they were inviting. So here I am. And hopefully somebody gets some help from anything I have to say today. I'm going to tell you a little story about a 12-step call where I live, and this will give you an idea of where I live. I live in Corning, Iowa, and the type of place I live in, this is a story that could be very true where I live. An old drunk gets a phone call, and he's with a newcomer at the time, and it's a 12-step phone call, and they get on the road, and they go down the highway about 40 miles and then get on the gravel road and then get on the county road or the county road and then the gravel road and then the dirt road. And by an hour and a half later, they get to this tumble-down lean-to, you know, burlap bag for the door. And it's just a lean-to, a shack out in the woods somewhere. And they go into this shack and there's a mattress on the floor and a milk crate with a tuna fish can and a candle on it and an old drunk sitting on the mattress. And the newcomer's been listening to this old timer for an hour and a half now in the car and on the trek into the woods. And he turns around to this guy. He looks around and he turns to this guy and he looks around, turns back to this guy, and he says, if you don't sober up, you're going to lose all of this. I've been down a few gravel roads in my day, but you know, not quite that far, but I have. And so that's where I live. So when we talk about going to any lengths, I am 40 miles from my women's group. I am 25 miles from my home group. And when you're around a lot of meetings, and it's so easy to get complacent, and I've learned not to do that, you know, because I've had to go to any lengths. Okay. My story. My story starts out, I was born in San Francisco. My family moved to New York right after I was born. And we lived in New York until I was 14. While living in New York, we lived in a small town in Katona, New York. It's in Westchester County. And it was just a little town. And whatever happened in my life, I don't know that I was really there for any of it. I was not an emotional participant in my life ever. And I never got attached. I never wanted to. Never wanted to be perfect. You had to work too hard. I got along. I survived. And I got into trouble on a regular basis. Long before I ever took my first drink, the signs of alcoholism were there. My earliest childhood memory is of when I was 3 years old. And a boy wouldn't tie my shoe and I hit him with a rock. And then laughed. I thought that was funny. What I learned at that time was if I apologize, I get out of trouble quicker. So I learned how to apologize. And I learned how to be, you know, there, kind of a warm body going through the motions, but I was not an emotional participant. I did what I needed to do to survive. started my drinking when I was about 12. I'm not really sure. I don't have a lot of brain cells left, and they argue with each other. So I don't have a lot of memories, concrete memories. I remember vague things. But I do remember some key points of my drinking. You know, I remember I don't know if it was the first time I drank, but it was the first time I got drunk. And I was not a popular kid. I did not get along. And by the time that I started drinking, my father had left when I was 9, and my parents got divorced. And I don't remember him being around much before then, but there were 7 kids in my family, so he had to have been there sometime. But the thing was, my mother was passed out drunk on the couch, and I was on my own. All of us were, when we were all living our own separate lives. And so, you know, I was taken off and going doing things that no self-respecting person should be doing, let alone a 12-year-old. And hitchhiking and, you know, doing that kind of thing. And all about going out and partying and drinking. And I don't know, like I said, from the time it started, that was the priority of everything in my life. It was the decision maker. It was the absolute everything of my life once I started drinking. My first drunk, I went to a party with a bunch of guys. The guy I was with was on crutches at the time. He had a broken foot. On the way home from that party, and I got drunk and got stupid, but on the way home from that party, I was helping him drive the car. And I was about 13, I think, maybe 13, I don't know, somewhere in there. But I was helping him drive the car, and we ended up getting into a wreck. Now, it wasn't until a couple of years sober that I realized that we caused the wreck, not the oncoming car, because we crossed their path and went down in the woods. Nobody was hurt, and it wasn't that bad a wreck, but I remember at that time, when the officer came and took the report, that I remember this guy saying it was their fault, this old couple, they had to have been 50, you know, and I don't think that anymore. This old couple, it had to have been their fault. It had to have been them. And he said that, and I looked and I thought, yeah, that's right. That's what it was. And so my mind, you know, makes up this stuff as I go along, and whatever lie suits my purpose for the moment, that's what I'm going to tell or agree with or whatever. And so I went along with that lie. The officer, he took me to the police station and then had to take me home later, when I was at this party, let me back up a little bit. When I was at this party, I was thinking, I'm going to go to school on Monday, and I'm going to be one of the cool kids now because I've been at this party drinking with all these older guys, you know, the 18-year-olds. Because in New York at that time, the drinking age was 18. And so anyway, this officer was the father of one of my classmates. His daughter was one of my classmates. And I went to school on Monday morning, and not only was I not one of the cool kids, I was the biggest slut in town because I'd been at this party with all these guys. So I was quickly learning that, you know, how to get a reputation, and then from there on quickly learned how to live up to it. And that led to a lot of guilt and shame later in my life and, you know, throughout my life. But anyway, that was the beginning of me drinking and getting into trouble. And it was to be, that was the way it was going to be from then on. Not every time I drank, I got into trouble. And a lot of times I drank, I had a lot of fun. A lot of times I drank, there was no consequences. I had a lot of fun for a lot of years. And I don't think I would have stayed out there that long if I hadn't been having a lot of fun. But, you know, a lot of it was. A lot of it was trouble. Of course, I never knew that because drinking was my way out of trouble or my way to solve a solution, solve a problem, or, you know, that was my solution, not my problem. After this happened and a couple of other episodes, my father got wind of it. He was living in California at the time, and he had married a woman that was like 28 at the time, 29 when we went to live with them, and decided that he'd be, in alcoholic thinking, of course, that he would be a better parent than my mother, who was passed out on the couch, you know, at least he was still working at the time, you know, and he decided, he married this woman and came and got 6 of us, the 6 of us that were actually his, my older sister has a different father, but he came and got the 6 of us and moved us to California in a custody kidnapping. And, you know, that's a drunk's best thinking, obviously. And he gets us to California, and we set up housekeeping there. And my stepmother is the epitome of the evil stepmother. She is abusive. She is physically abusive. abusive, emotionally abusive, mentally abusive in every way. She is jealous of us kids, particularly me, because I was my father's first daughter, and she didn't like that. And plus, I looked somewhat like my mother, and she didn't like that. So we didn't start off on a very good footing. This woman, she went on to be abusive the whole time I lived with them. My father ended up getting transferred to Australia, and so off we go to Australia to set up housekeeping. By this time, I am sneaking out of the house on a regular basis and getting drunk. I mean, on a nightly basis. I'm looking to get out of the house and go do whatever it is that I can do to escape the reality that I live in. Because where I'm at doesn't look so good. And everybody else does. Of course, I've since learned that, you know, the grass is greener on the other side because the other guy takes better care of his lawn. We moved to Australia, and I'm sneaking out of the house. My parents put me in an all-girls school. That's not going to work. That's not going to fly. There's no boys here. I can't go there. But it's an hour and a half to get to school, an hour to an hour and a half to get to school, and I have to go to take a bus and then change buses and then go to the school, which is way out in the country somewhere, and then do the same coming home, you know. So I'm doing this on a daily, well, I don't like this idea, so I get off the bus in Perth and go party and spend my days going and partying and drinking and, you know, whatever I do. You know, the skirt gets hiked up and the jacket goes off and the shirt gets tied into a little bow here and, you know, and the Oxfords were a problem, though, you know, those shoes. And the hat gets ditched in the book bag, and, you know, I mean, because they really did the whole nine yards with the uniform hat and tie and the whole thing. And so I, you know, ditched the uniform image, and, you know, I would go play. And this went on, and I was finally, I ended up getting kicked out of that school, and I ran running away from home and doing things like that. Then I hooked up with a guy on one of my escapades, sneaking out and getting drunk. I snuck out and got drunk and got pregnant. I was 15 years old, living in Australia, and this did not seem like a very good place to be right now, you know. And my thinking was, well, of course I'm going to have the baby. And this was before anybody even knew I was pregnant, you know. When I found out I was pregnant, of course I'm going to have the baby. And the father had just been enlisted in the military, in the Australian Air Force, so he was gone already. He was going to be gone already. And I didn't have any emotional attachment to him. Like I said, I was not an emotional participant in my life. And so I didn't really care, you know. I mean, I'd survive. I always did. I like to say that God watches out for drunks and fools. And as you'll see, I have his attention on both counts in my entire life. Anyway, he takes off, and I'm pregnant, and things are not the best at home. And one day, my stepmother, in one of her abusive rages, goes to hit my brother with a cane. And I hauled off and decked her. And I'm not going to, no. Now you've gone too far. You're hitting my brothers. You know, when you hit me, then I can take that. But when you hit one of my brothers or sisters, that's it. I'm done. And I decked her. But I also, and looking back, of course, we live our lives in retrospect. I didn't know it at the time. But what I was feeling was a lot of fear and a lot of rage and a lot of, I can't do this anymore. Plus I'm pregnant, and I just go, I've got to go. I've got to leave, you know. And which was my answer to a lot of things, was to leave. So I did. I was kicked out of school. My parents were going to put me in a home for incorrigible people. I wasn't going to go for that either. They'd taken me to tour the place, and I thought, oh, no. And then, you know, then they left me home alone. My father went to work. The other kids went to school. My stepmother takes off to go shopping one day. And I'm thinking, carte blanche, I'm gone. Pack a bag. So I go and I pack a bag and I go down behind our house. We had an alley that went off, and, you know, I went like back roads all the way into the city, Perth, and we lived in South Perth at the time. And I got to Perth and hooked up with a friend of a friend of the father of my baby, and he was going to go hitchhike across the outback to Melbourne. And I thought, well, that sounds like a really good idea. Let's go. And off we went. and I hitchhiked with this strange man, never met before, across the outback in Australia, 15 years old and 2 months pregnant, and I did not see anything wrong with that idea. That's a perfectly good idea, you know. My drunk thinking says, yeah, that works, yeah. And so here we are, we're living in Melbourne, and I set up housekeeping. I, you know, there was a part of me always that was a responsible, moralistic type of person that had standards and beliefs, and there was that part of me also, and that part came out when I was living in Melbourne, and I got a job, and I set up housekeeping, and, you know, plus I was drinking and pregnant and, you know, whatever else was going on. Realized that I had to stop drinking, though, with that. And that was probably the hardest thing I ever did because I wanted to keep drinking. But I always follow myself into these situations. And so that other part of me that is not responsible and not moralistic follows me and takes over. And takes over those situations and makes the bad decisions for me. The alcoholic in me that always makes those bad decisions again, and again I have to go. I ended up getting found. Somebody that I had been, one of the gals that had been to the one of the schools I had been kicked out of, she was visiting in Melbourne and happened to see me at my job. I was working in a retail thing or something, and she saw me and went back and reported that she'd seen me because apparently there was a missing persons thing on me, you know, and that running away was illegal, and so. They caught up with me, and by this time I was like 5 months pregnant, and they caught up with me and brought me back to Perth and put me in first juvenile hall and then a home for unwed mothers, and that's where my daughter was born. And I got to tell you about my daughter Heidi being born, and she was born 20 days before I turned 15, I mean before I turned 16, and I knew that. In all the time of my life, I'd never tried to be perfect, but when my daughter was born, I wanted to be perfect. I wanted to be a perfect mother. I wanted to be a perfect... I wanted to have a perfect love, and I thought I could do this. And there was no question in my mind that I was going to keep her, and this home for unmarried mothers and these nurses and these nuns and whatever they were, you know, where I had been living... They didn't want that to happen, and it was after she was born. It was 2 weeks before I saw her again, and they finally gave up and let me have her and let me feed her and let me have her in a room with me. And I thought, yeah, we're going to be okay. We're going to do this. We're going to be okay. And you know, it wasn't very long after that that my alcoholism caught up with me, and I left and went to you know, set up housekeeping, did the responsible thing, was getting a job, you know, doing that, taking care of my daughter, and I was doing school by correspondence. I was doing it all. I was doing the responsible thing, the right thing. I was trying to take care of business, but my alcoholism is there, present, all the time, and it catches up with me, and it stops me dead in my tracks from doing any of that stuff anymore, and it did, and I was getting into a lot of trouble again, and my daughter, now I've got a baby that I'm carrying around with me into this trouble. She was going to be made a ward of the state. I was put back in a juvenile facility. In the meantime, by the way, I had been declared an emancipated minor. You know, I had some guys in Melbourne that thought that would be a good idea, so they petitioned the court, and I was actually declared an emancipated minor. So when I was put back in this, went after this, and they were going to put me back in this juvenile hall, they couldn't keep me there very long because I was an emancipated minor, so I was on my own. But they could take my daughter. And so they were going to make her a ward of the state. So I thought, well, the best thing for me to do is let my father and my stepmother have her. Now, much as I hated them, this was a decision. I had emotionally participated in her birth. First time ever I remember doing that. I emotionally participated in a decision to let them have her because she was going to be better off with them, and at least when we left Australia, which was coming up, I could get her out, you know, that she'd go with them. And so I let them have her, and then I proceeded to go on and do whatever I was doing, you know, because now I didn't have that responsibility. And that emotional participation stopped. I stopped being a part of her life. Part of that was with my own choice. Part of that was my alcoholism, part of that was my stepmother not letting me be there. But I didn't care anymore. I We did come back to the States, and when we got back to the States, I went back to school, got back into high school, and never did graduate. Didn't, you know, my credits were so skewed and stuff. I never did graduate. I was only a few credits short, but never did graduate from high school. And during this time, my father and my stepmother petitioned to adopt my daughter. And I went kicking and screaming to that decision, bawled like a baby when I signed those papers, and knew that it was the best thing I could do for her. It was, at that point in my life, I believe, the most unselfish decision I could make. I was not thinking about me for once. I was thinking about her. And that was done. And so now I can go on to not emotionally participating in my life and take off and go do what I do best, and that's to party and to drink and to carry on and to try and have a job and not be able to keep one. And I never did keep a job for very long. I don't think I had any job in my life for more than a few months, or I think a couple of years was the longest I lasted. That was later on, you know, when I was older. But I went on and did life, you know, and I'm going to kind of fast forward here. I ended up moving to Hawaii. I was about 20, and went into a bar, and I wasn't old enough to be in the bar anyway, but I managed to get through into bars all the time. And this guy said, when I ordered a drink, he said it was on him, and the next thing I know, I'm flying to Hawaii to go, you know, he said, yo, come visit me in Hawaii, come see me in Hawaii. And the next thing I know, I'm off to Hawaii to go visit him, and you know, and I set up housekeeping there. He and I had a relationship for about a year and a half, and then went our separate ways. But you know, I got to Hawaii and I got there drunk and stayed there drunk for 21 years. It was a party place. I loved Hawaii. God, oh, it was a great place to party. And I made more geographicals on an island than you could. I mean, I moved constantly. And eventually moved, and I was living in Wahiawa, which is in the middle of the island. Now, I'm way fast forward now, you know. During this time, I did go to school. I did get, like, an associate's degree and that kind of thing. And, you know, I started getting some jobs, and, you know, and later on I was getting a little more responsible, even though my drinking was getting worse. You know, for some reason I kind of managed to get that. But and there was a lot of drugs involved and a lot of all that other stuff. That's part of my story, you know, but the cocaine in the 80s in Hawaii was unbelievable. But, you know, and that is part of my story, and that was a part of my getting into trouble, too. I realized that that's going to get me into trouble. That's going to really get me into trouble. I better leave that alone. Never occurred to me that the alcohol was getting me into more trouble. So anyway, so I'm living in Hawaii and drinking on a regular basis, and one weekend I had gotten into a wreck, drunk, total my car, and you know, I thought, oh man, you know, now I got to take the bus. And a week later, Friday comes along. Now the bus in Hawaii is pretty good, but it doesn't, you know, a lot of the buses don't run after like 7:30 at night. So I had to go to work, and I went to work that day, and I took the bus, and the bus goes by the bar, and I stop at the bar, and I think, okay, now unless I get a ride home, I'm going to have to, you know, my alcoholic thinking and planning, unless I get a ride home, I am going to have to get on that bus again at 7:30. Now, well, that's not going to work because I need to drink, you know. It's a Friday night. Hell, I'm not going home at 7:30. So I got to get a ride home. I walk into the bar, and my husband is sitting there. And Mark and I had had one date about a year and a half prior to that, you know, both of us kind of went our separate ways. He lived real close to me, though. And so, you know, we would see each other at the bar and drink and party together, but, you know, it didn't really go on from there. And that night, I saw him sitting at the bar, and I walked up to him, and I said, I'm glad you're here. Can I get a ride home with you tonight? And he said, don't you think I've waited long enough? And 6 weeks later, we were married. I swore two things when I lived in Hawaii. I swore I'd never get mixed up with a military man and I'd never leave Hawaii. A year after we were married, he retired from the Navy and we moved to Iowa. I'm thinking, Iowa, oh my God, what am I going to do here? My friend, the bartender, was you know, singing Green Acres, and Johnny at the bar was, little Johnny, who was 10 foot tall and bulletproof when he drank, you know, said, he laughed his way off the bar stool, and, you know, this was, and they came to see us off in bib overalls and straw hats. It was pretty comical, but we ended up in Iowa, and I thought, I cried all the way, and I thought, what am I going to do in Iowa? Oh my God, what am I going to do? Now, I got to tell you, you know, it never occurred to me that if my husband's going to Iowa that I wouldn't be going with him, because there was something that happened when I married my husband that I knew this was the man I was going to spend the rest of my life with. And so far, that's still true. But there was, so I had to go to Iowa. I'm married now. I have to go to Iowa. I have made this choice to be with this man. And there's that sane part of my thinking that's still there a little bit that says, yeah, that's the right thing to do. And I did. So I end up going to Iowa, and we it was night when we came in, and I was, you know, still just crazy, you know, and pretty drunk by the time we got there, you know, drinking on the plane and stuff, and bothering the heck out of him. He was trying to sleep on the plane, and I'm crying, oh, what am I going to do? And so we get there, and the next day, my mother-in-law takes me down into the town. And this is, Corning, Iowa is a town of about, now has about 3,000 people. At that time, it was about 1,200. The town was about 1,200. The whole county was about 2,000. Our whole county now is about maybe 4,000. I kind of looked it up the other day. But we where we're living now is Brooks, Iowa, which is about 5 miles out. We stayed in Brooks. That was his parents' house. And so we went to stay with his parents for 6 months. And she took me into town, and there's three bars in Corning. Three bars. The whole town is like 1 mile, square mile, if that. And that's getting to the outside of town. You know, we have like two main streets and, you know, one a main street and a back street, and then that's it. And that's and three bars. And I thought, cool. I'm all right. And then this little burg that we're living in, 5 miles out of Corning, has a bar also. So I'm thinking, I can walk to that one. So I figure, I'm fine. We're going to be fine. Everything's going to be fine. We're going to live happily ever after. Not going to happen. What ended up happening was we were both into our alcoholism too far to turn back. You know, I mean, there was just that the alcoholism was taking over. My husband's father, true alcoholic that he was till the day he died, was getting to his one of his bottoms. Things were going on. They had been up in Minnesota, him and his dad, and his father had fallen and hurt himself and got Mark up in the middle of the night to take him home, saying that he had to go see the doctor in Corning. They were up in Minnesota. They were, you know, 8 hours away in Minnesota. My husband gets up and drives him home and gets him home in 5 hours. There was no doctor's appointment. It was all a lie. You know, nothing was going on. And this was the beginning of the end for us. Unfortunately, not for his alcoholism, but for us drinking, because what had happened was my husband's going off to, Mark is going off to slay the dragons of his parents, because he had to commit his father for alcoholism, and he went into the DTs and was, you know, in a diaper and still didn't get it. He had to commit his father. Then his mother had to go into the psych ward, and they were down the hall from each other. You know, this is an Al-Anon's and alcoholic's dream. I mean, you know, she's down the hall making sure that he's getting taken care of, and I mean, It was pretty a mess. And he's driving, and this is 75 miles away, and he's driving over there to slay the dragons of his parents and going on and on and on. And I'm not going to get all the way into his story with that, but what happened was he went to a guy in town that was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he went to this man, and he said to this man, what can I do to help my dad? I'll do anything to help my dad. And this man looked at him and said, how can you help? You're still drinking. And Mark came to my office. I was working. He was not at the time. He was retired. He figured as long as I could buy him shotgun shells, he was going to be okay. He showed up at my office, and he said, I'm quitting drinking. And, of course, my answer is, I don't have a problem. No problem. You know, well, that's nice, honey. I just go to unwind anyway, you know. I mean, I just, that's my thing. I just go to unwind. I don't have a problem. So, you know, if you need to quit drinking, that's okay. You know, I can live with that. And he started going to meetings. And this, 2 days later, I have my last drunk. I'm in a drunken rage. He's still dealing with all this stuff with his parents. And he's in a drunken rage. I throw him out of the house, wait long enough for him to get to his mother's house, and call him up and say, if you ever come back here, I just might not be here. And he said I threatened to commit suicide, and I don't know, that's probably what I said, but I don't remember it quite that way. But the thing is he called the police, and the police came, and this cute young cop comes walking in the door, and I think I offered him a drink. And I asked this, and he said, he goes out, and he says he's going to wait for Mark, and they go out. And I'm looking down our hallway, and there's a chiffon panel on the, you know, kind of a clear panel on the door. And I can see them out in the street. And I remember thinking, I wish they'd hurry up and leave so I can finish off that six-pack that's in the refrigerator. And they left, and I did. You know, he had told Mark I was okay. I believe Mark was done at that time, for that moment anyway. And I finished off that six pack, and it occurred to me that I actually finished off all but one of them, and I didn't remember this until this morning, actually, so this is kind of interesting. There was still one in there. The next day, that night, actually, something happened. Something happened when I went to bed that night, drunk and crazy and angry and hurting. I went to bed that night, and I said to myself, what have I done now? In all my life, it had been, look what's happened to me. Look what you did to me. How could you have done that to me? You know, poor me, poor me, poor me another. This time it was, what have I done? And I went to bed for the first time in my life feeling something I had never felt before, and that was remorse. I had never known that feeling before. And somewhere in there was a prayer about needing help. And I don't know if I put it into words, but it was there, and it was in my heart, and I knew I was done. And the next day I went to work, and somebody said hello to me, and I burst into tears and said, my husband left me. Of course, I hadn't learned to tell the truth yet, but my boss, who at the time, and she was a lady that I'd had a few drinks with from time to time. She was an interesting lady, and she said to me, Sarah, if you're having problems in your life, why don't you call our employee assistance program? So I did. I called our employee assistance program. I thought, that's the tool. That's it. That's what I'll do. Counseling. That's what I need. Counseling. So I called this man, and he came to visit me in my office, and we talked. It was after everybody else had gone. It was just him and I, and he came to visit me in my office. You know, and I told him about my drinking a little bit. I said, yeah, I just go to unwind. I mean, you know, I don't understand what the big deal is, you know. I just go to unwind, and I don't know what, you know, what's the big deal? And, you know, and with this going on and that going on and this going on and that going on, you know, and I have a lot of stress, and I'm new here, and I don't have any other friends but in the bar, and on and on. And he said, you're right, Sarah. You know, I wouldn't blame you if you went out and got rip-roaring drunk right now. And you might as well have kicked me in the stomach, because that was... It hit me like, oh my God, I felt so sick inside when he said that. I felt like just throwing up. I mean, it's like, I don't want to do that. And knowing I didn't know how not to do that. I didn't know. I was at that jumping off place. What do I do now? I know I don't want to do that anymore. I know I don't want to do that drinking anymore. And I don't know how not to do that drinking anymore. That is my life. That's how I do things. And he said to me, Sarah, if alcohol is causing problems in your life, you may be an alcoholic. And it was like, that was an answer. And it was an answer that was filled with hope for some reason. It filled me with a feeling of, oh my God, I might be able to do this. That man, by the way, for any of you who are involved in CPC work and that kind of thing, that man was 17 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and 12-stepped me in my office. I went home and I called my husband, who had 2 days of sobriety at the time, and told him that if he ever decided to come back, I'd be there, and I wouldn't blame him if he didn't. And my husband said to me, I believe the words that allowed me to get sober and to stay sober. He said, Sarah, are you willing to quit drinking? If he had used any other words or had used an ultimatum or anything like that, I may not be here today. He said, are you willing? And I could do that. I could be willing. And he came home that night, and he gave me a copy of the Big Book, and he went to a meeting. I was too sick to go out. And he gave me a copy of the Big Book, and for some reason told me to read the chapter Two Wives. Funny thing about that beer I remembered this morning, because I had forgotten all about that until this morning. That beer that was in the refrigerator, I opened that Big Book and opened that beer. And when I opened the, I opened the beer first and opened the Big Book to that chapter. And then I opened that Big Book, and that beer got thrown down the toilet after I started reading the Big Book. The Big Book stayed open. The beer got thrown away. Never. And I didn't remember that till this morning, and that is so, open the book. It's got everything I need to do, all the instructions to do those things, and it tells me what is going to happen if I don't do them. Mark and I started going to a lot of meetings. Now, let me tell you, then there was even fewer meetings than there are now. And so we were trying to, there's no way you can do 90 meetings in 90 days where we live. There's just no way. But it wasn't for lack of trying, believe me. We would take off and go to a meeting. We had one meeting in Corning at the time, and it was on Monday night. So my first meeting was on a Saturday night, and it was in Bedford, Iowa. That was 30 miles away. And we went in there, and I remember sitting around the table. There was only about six of us, and my husband got a big, they had a soft cover Big Book, and he gave me my own Big Book. That was my first own Big Book, and I still have that one. But, you know, and he put his name in it, too, and he signed it, you know, for me. And backing up a little bit, when he came home, when he'd asked me if I was willing to quit drinking and came home, I'm here to tell you that, you know, if you don't think you can stay sober as a couple, yes, you can. And if you don't think you can stay together as a couple, yes, you can. We are still together. We celebrated 15 years of marriage on our last anniversary. So we stayed sober together, and I think we had to do a lot of 12-step work with each other, you know, because in order to do that. But anyway, we were trying to, like I said, go to meetings, and as many as we could. At about a month of sobriety, we decided we were going to take off. My best friend from Hawaii, who was a bartender in Hawaii, was originally from Iowa. She was coming back for a family reunion, so we thought we'd go and see her. Well, her identical twin sister was 6 months sober at the time, and Mark and I were a month, and so we thought we'd go. It was up in, like, Waterloo, Iowa. We went to meetings up there and dragged Carol along with us, who was not sober at the time. During the weekend, her beer kept moving further and further behind her, though. You know, she's like, we're talking AA, and she's... And 6 weeks later, she got sober. We dragged her to a meeting with us. But what had ended up happening for us is that we got into sobriety, but we also got into the fellowship. We got into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we got into the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are members. We want to know what the membership is. I want to know what I'm a member of, and I looked for that. I wanted to see what that was, a full participant. Because up until that point, I had not been, like I said, I can count on one hand the number of times I emotionally participated in my life. When Mark said, are you willing to quit drinking, that was one of them. When I married him, that was one of them. That was one of the times I emotionally participated in my life. And when I got into sobriety and the first time I opened my mouth and said I was an alcoholic, I emotionally participated in that event. And I had not known how that felt. And the biggest weight had been lifted off of me at that time. We took off with sobriety, like with a vengeance. And like I said, a lot of road tripping. I believe one of our sayings should be, shut up and get in the car, because that's what we say in Iowa now. Shut up and get in the car. And we have to do that. We go on road trips, you know? And so, and I have a button. I was going to bring buttons for everybody, but I couldn't get them all. But I believe that's true. I actually said that at the West Central Regional AA Service Conference one weekend, and somebody sent me a bunch of buttons that say that after that conference. But anyway, we took off, and I'm trying to learn. I'm going to meetings with a bunch of farm boys. This, it's Corning, Iowa, there's farm boys. Now, I never drank with farm boys, so you know the old pamphlet that says, do you think you're different? I was looking for some answers in that. There was nothing about farm boys in there. But I was sobering up with farm boys, and there was a sense. I didn't really feel quite there or quite connected in some ways, but then there was a sense. There was a sense of connection with these guys. You know, these, by the way, good-looking guys talking about their feelings. I heard my sponsor say that before, and that was true for me too, that good-looking guys talking about their feelings is pretty attractive. It'll keep you coming back for a while until you get something else that's a little more substantial. But so I'm with these guys, and I'm thinking, I don't know how to do this. And they keep talking about a sponsor, and you know, I don't know about sponsors, and you know, and I'm working the steps. I'm trying anyway, you know, and I know I've got to do what I've got to do. And then so I asked a woman to be my sponsor because I liked the way she laughed. Well, it turned out she lived 75 miles away from me, and that's all she had going for her was that she liked to laugh, and I'm sorry to say that, but it was a lesson. It was a lesson that I guess I had to go through, and I said when I found out how far she was, I said it would be temporary, so she said, well, yeah, well, I'm not sure I can do temporary. And then she said, yes, and I don't know. So I didn't know anything about finding a sponsor. And these guys couldn't really tell me what I was looking for, what I had to look for. I had to know that for myself. And the next lady I asked to be my sponsor was at least not a long-distance phone call. And at that time, we didn't have cell phones. She was not a long-distance phone call. And I called her up on the phone. I'd gotten her number from someone, and I called her up, and I said, asked her, you know, if I could meet her, and she came to, and she was a lovely lady, and I just loved her, and she was my sponsor up until I got my current sponsor, and we were working together, but there was kind of a disconnection there because I think my story scared her, you know, so there was kind of, it was there, and I love her dearly. I'm still very good friends with her, but there was something there that wasn't working for both of us. Anyway, one night, I had been asked to speak at the prison in Clarinda, and I had never spoken anywhere before in my life, and I'm going to a men's prison to speak. And I had met my sponsor at meetings and, you know, and seen her, and she had something about her that was, she had an air of spirit about her, an air of God about her that, I mean, you know, that God feeling came from her. And I'd see her, and she had the great laugh, too. So I called her up. I knew she had been to the prison and spoken there, and I called her up, and I asked her, how do you do this? What do you do? And she said, well, you know, you dress this way and dress appropriately, and it's their rules, and you know, and what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and what drunk doesn't like to talk about themselves. And before we went, she said, before we go over there, we're going to go on a 12-step call. And my sponsor took me on my first 12-step call. Well, I shouldn't say my first. It was my first that was appropriate 12-step call. We had me and this gal was kind of she and I kind of co-sponsored each other until we found sponsors. But we had tried to talk to some women drunks before, but we weren't doing a very good job of it. And I watched my sponsor talk to this woman, and with such grace and dignity. And I watched this woman with the look of hope in her eyes. And she was getting ready to go off and do some really hard time. And I saw that woman, at least for that moment, have hope. And I thought, I want that. And that night I asked Lisa to be my sponsor. And she's been my sponsor ever since. I'm going to tell you about the woman I had sobered up with. She was on police dispatch. She worked for police dispatch. And she was 6 weeks sober when that call came into the police station. And she'd seen me in the bar, you know. Sheila was 6 weeks sober at that time and said she started praying for me. So the first time I actually met her was at a meeting, but she had seen me at the bar. So those prayers work, I guess. Anyway, that was when I asked Lisa to be my sponsor, and I was getting into, Lisa was also very involved in service, and I feel that that's the important thing that we need to understand about service, is it gets us into, out of ourselves, and into something else, but it's a much bigger picture than that. The Alcoholics Anonymous needs this, you know, those things to keep functioning, and we need those people that suit up and show up and take those meetings into the jails and take those meetings into, you know, different places. And the county jail for me was one of my biggest things. I love doing service. I love the general service structure too, though. Before I was I was about 9 months sober. I had was elected GSR of that little group in Corning. I fulfilled that commitment and have not been a member of that group since. Because there were members in that group when I was elected for GSR, there was an old guy in that group that said there was one other guy that wanted to be GSR, and not that he wanted to be GSR just because somebody else was going to take it, that the guy said, I think the two people who want to be GSR should take it out in the hallways and duke it out, and whoever comes back standing is our next GSR. And that was my introduction to service, but it was also an introduction to me finding out that that's not the way it works, you know, because I thought, no, that couldn't possibly be right. And so I got into service, and I went on and I have continuously for about 12 years now been involved in the general service structure, and it has been one of the cornerstones of my sobriety. I cannot do sobriety without doing that. I cannot do sobriety without being a full and complete participating emotionally, physically, spiritual member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you. I had notes I've never even looked at yet. I talked a little bit about the perfection thing and that I never wanted to be perfect. It was too hard work. And the only thing we can do perfectly is admit that we're an alcoholic. The only thing that we can do perfectly is the first step. The only thing we can do perfectly is say that I am powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. And I did that. And I knew that until I stopped drinking decided what I was going to do, what I was going to wear, where I was going to go, who I was going to be with. It decided, it made every choice in my life. It decided if I was going to keep a job, lose a job. It decided. It decided if I was going to be happy or sad. It decided. Alcoholism decided that for me. I believe I'm as powerless over alcohol today as I was when I first walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe if I pick up a drink today, I'm off and running, because that drink picks up a drink and that drink takes me. You know, I take a drink, the drink takes a drink, and the drink takes me, and I'm gone. I believe that today. I believe that I have to admit that every day. And I get on my knees and I admit that every day. And I believe that, you know, I came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I believe that. I believe that the only way that I could get away from that stuff that was blocking me from every spirit, from everything right in this world, was that if something else did it. Somebody, something else had to do it. You know, we talk about that doorknob. You know, you say, well, pick a clock on the wall or pick a doorknob or something like that. I thought, doorknob, now that is the stupidest idea I have ever heard. And somebody said, you know, when you walk out a door, you need to turn that knob. And I thought, oh, yeah, that doorknob's pretty powerful, isn't it? That doorknob's pretty essential, isn't it? I believe that's a good good way to look at it, to turn that knob. And when you want to come in or out of that door, you got to use that doorknob. And so I thought, oh, yeah. I had always believed there was a God. I didn't believe in that God. I didn't trust God. I was afraid of God. God was angry. God was menacing. God was, you know, what God was going to strike me down with lightning one day, because, I mean, I was a bad, bad person, you know. And I really believed that. I believed in my heart of hearts that there was no way God could ever love me. I'm here to tell you, I don't believe that anymore. I know God loves me. He loves, my God is big enough to love me no matter what I do, no matter what I do. And my God forgives me no matter what I do. And my God lets me know that on a daily basis. When I do a lot of road trips because, I mean, that's where I'm at. But when I was driving down the road one day, I was in my car driving down the road one day, and I was listening to a speaker, and they talked about, they said the third step. And that word care jumped out at me. You know, we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. Absolutely. I can let God take care of me. I don't have to turn, I'm not trying to have God control me or use me as a puppet or anything like that. God is taking care of me. God, you know, if God brings me to it, he's going to bring me through it. And he does on a daily basis, all the time. Taking care of me. And I love that, and I think that's the most important word in that step. I learned very early in sobriety to say my prayers on my knees, and I do that, and I say the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer every day. And I also say some other prayers. And I also report for duty every day. I say there was a poem once that said, it's actually on a flip calendar, and I don't know why I remember the date, but it was August 31st, and it says what an angel might say, and it says, an angel says, the prayers that carry the most weight and are of the rarest beauty are those in which we don't demand but just report for duty. So I get up every morning from my knees and I report for duty, and I let God take care of me, you know, and I try to put myself in God's will. And, you know, I'm learning, and it's just been the past couple of years that I have learned to really let go with faith. I mean, to take those leaps of faith. I never thought I would see that day when I wouldn't worry incessantly about things, but I do. And I have hope, and I have faith, and the faith leads to hope. I think hope with, you know, when you just hope and something happens, that's a wish. But when you add faith, when you have faith, that's the most important thing. And I have faith, unbelievable faith in my God now. A little bit of fast forward again. I at about 7 years of sobriety, my husband is disabled and was suffering a lot of pain and problems at the time, and we were going to a lot of doctors and doing a lot of that, and they gave him medications and more medications and more medications, and we went through this with sponsors and with friends in the program and said, how do we do, we don't, you know, what, is this okay? Can we do this? Can he take those medications? You know, what about this? What about, is this going to be okay? This is going to be okay? This is going to be okay? And it wasn't. And we had to put him into treatment eventually for that. What ended up happening was that he kept going down and down and down, and, you know, and there was a lot of fear and there was a lot of other stuff involved. And eventually, first we put him into a pain management clinic, and they took him off the meds and put him on methadone and then he was there like during the week. It wasn't an inpatient, but he was there because we live so far away. He was there during the week, and he would come home on the weekends, and he was a mess. He was miserable, just dying. And he went back the second week, and on Wednesday he comes home. He's starting to come home, and he calls me on the phone, and he says, I just want to drive off a bridge. I'm just going to drive off a bridge. And I'm 75 miles away, and I don't know what to do. And I told him, honey, hang in there until you get home. Just hang in there and just come home. And I called his doctor and told him what was going on, and he prescribed some methadose and said, you know, okay, get him home. And he finally got home, and we got him on the methadose and calmed him down and everything like that. And the next day we took him to a doctor, and then we took him to a psychiatrist, and then we checked him into treatment. And he had to be weaned off those drugs, and then he had to be weaned off the methadose because the little country doctor that we have didn't know how much to prescribe and overprescribed him on the methadose. So we had a double whammy there. And during the time when he was in that treatment, 75 miles away, we're back where we started from, 75 miles away, in the same hospital that his father had been in when his father was first checked into treatment. And I'm going back and forth. I'm an Al-Anonic alcoholic. I'm going back and forth. I've got to fix this. I've got to go back and forth every day. And I'm driving back and forth to, you know, see him in treatment, going to a meeting, going nuts. And I call my sponsor, and she says, no, you just go on the weekend and maybe one day during the week, which I started doing. But, you know, during the course of all this, there was a time that came, and I had called a lady I know in the program who at that time had 30 years of sobriety, and an elderly lady, and I was just sobbing. I don't know what to do anymore. What am I going to do anymore? I don't know how to do this anymore. And I'm just sobbing and just crazy. And right as I'm saying this to her, my other phone rang, and it was the county jail calling. And they had a woman who needed help. Would you please come, Sarah? We have somebody here who needs help. And I get on the phone, and I go, I know what to do now. Nothing ensures our immunity from alcohol as intensive work with other alcoholics. And I'm here to tell you that I won't have it any other way. I've got to be amongst you guys, and I've got to make, because sometimes the still suffering drunk is sitting in a chair next to you at a meeting. Sometimes I'm the still suffering drunk. And so I want constant contact with that. You know, like I said, I'm very actively involved in the fellowship. I also try to hit at least 3 meetings a week. Not always easy to do. I mean, we get blizzards and stuff, and you can't go anywhere, you know. Now, I might have gone out in a blizzard to get a drink, but I'm not going to go out in a blizzard. I'm no good to anybody dead. Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well in Corning, Iowa. Well, in Iowa. And I am very grateful to be here. I'm just kind of running out of things to say, I think, so I'm about to sit down here now. Thank you for letting me come and share. And